Hello again, and welcome to the America Magazine podcast. This is Carrie Weber, Associate Editor. We're here today with Stephen Martin, a writer and columnist based in North Carolina. He is also a father of two who directs public relations for a global nonprofit and the author of the recent book, The Messy Quest for Meaning, Five Catholic Practices for Finding Your Vocation. It's out now and published by Soren Books. Hi, Stephen. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Carrie. Excited to be here.
Now, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what motivated you to write your book.
So many people, I think, are really struggling with questions of why am I here? What should I do with my life? And as I started to explore the idea of this book, I started talking to people about their ideas about calling and vocation. It was very interesting. A lot of people had very wildly differing ideas about what a calling is and how you find it, and most of them didn't feel like they were having a lot of success. And, you know, for example, you had some people who said, you know, I think I've already found my calling, but which is great. The challenge is that I think as you get older and get different experiences, your calling's probably going to change. Other people would say, I think I just have one calling, and it's out there somewhere, and I can't find it, which I think is a bit of a myth, too, because really I think people have many callings, and it's a question of not just finding one, but finding many. So there were a lot of questions like that, and in meeting with some Trappist monks that I talked to and helping develop this book, I started to see there were some ways to answer these questions about callings that really draw on the Catholic tradition, and probably a process that you could lead people through to help really make some progress and stop spinning their wheels. And so that's how the book got started.
So you went through your own sort of messy quest for your vocation and looking at your life and what you valued. Could you tell us a little bit about that process and how you kind of came out of that process with your own vocation?
Right. So the first couple chapters of the book are devoted to a time when I was in my mid-20s. I was living in Mount Airy, North Carolina, which is known as Mayberry on the Andy Griffith Show. And I was not having quite such an idyllic time down there. It was a time in my life where I wasn't eating very well, I wasn't exercising, didn't really like my job. I was a journalist at the time, and ended up with a pretty severe anxiety disorder. And it really was difficult to deal with for a span of about a year or more. And then at that point, I started realizing I've got to do something. I can't keep going on like this. Life needs to be more about just trying to get through the day. You know, I need to find a way to enjoy it. So I really started thinking back to some of these Trappist monks that I had visited in college, and I had gone back to these monasteries a few times and started to think there's got to be a way to translate some of what I've seen at these monasteries into my own life. And that's kind of where the book really started to come together. I mean, some of the ideas, the five different practices that the book explores were all based on Trappist traditions, and they're what personally led me out of my trials that I was going through there in my mid-20s, and it really sparked my interest in trying to help other people as well.
Could you talk a little bit more about those Trappist traditions and what struck you about them and what about them you felt applied to your life and your quest?
Sure. The first time I visited one of these monasteries, I was a senior in college and I had some friends going to one for spring break. And I thought, this is something I've never done. I've been to Miami and New Orleans and different places for spring break, and thought I'd try this. So we went to Mepkin Abbey, which is in South Carolina. Spent a full weekend there. We adhered to the monastic schedule the entire time, waking up at 3 in the morning, going to all the prayers, trying to go to bed at 8 o'clock. It's not easy. And by the time we left, we were exhausted, and also realizing that there's just tremendous wisdom here. And it was really a matter of just trying to distill what some of that is. It was such kind of a shocking experience, unlike anything I'd ever gone through before, that it really took some time to tease that out. But it has a lot to do, I think, with knowing what you're here for, really figuring out what your desires are. And this is the first practice in the book, is understanding what you're really drawn towards. And then the book kind of builds from there.
What do you think is the biggest distraction to finding one's vocation? Because it sounds like if you go to a Trappist monastery, there's a lot of quiet, there's a lot of time to think. But if you don't have time to go to the monastery, how do you find that vocation?
I think the biggest distraction actually is probably your own preconceptions about what a calling should be or what a vocation should be. I think being out in the world is fine. I think that it's probably a challenge for those within a monastery to really zero in on, move more deeply into their calling as well. It's not an easy process for anybody. But I do think that when you're out in the world, what you got to do is actually make the time for it. It's the biggest challenge, I think, is it takes a lot of work, and you don't see results very quickly a lot of times. And it could take, I mean, this is really a lifetime journey. And you could go years at a time, as some of the people I write about in the book have gone, with very little progress that you can measure. And so I think the biggest challenge is just frustration and giving up and feeling like it's not going somewhere. But even if you can step back and see that you're even making a little bit of progress, that could be enough to keep you going.
One of the values you talk about is humility and having the humility to sort of accept where you're being led, which is sort of an interesting quality to think about when you think of vocation as something you're sort of aspiring towards. Or how do you balance that idea of trying to both be humble and believe in yourself enough to sort of move toward a vocation?
That's a great question. I think that you do need to have some belief in yourself, and I think you need to believe that you have a reason that you're here, and the challenge is to find out what it is. And really the way to find that out, one of the ways to find that out is to not be too absorbed with yourself and to start trying to learn from other people, to learn from your mistakes, to know that you're going to make mistakes and that's a good thing. And you're going to go through unfortunate experiences. And a lot of the time that's going to be good for you as well, because that gets you to a place where you really can be humble in the sense of believing that you don't know everything, that you can learn. And also just a willingness to be led by the circumstances of your life. I think everybody, at least I, want to try to control things. I have a strong tendency to want to do that. I like order. I think a lot of us do. But really, it takes humility to realize that whatever circumstance you're facing right now that's a circumstance that God's trying to put in front of you, and you can learn from that. And that's, I think we resist that. It's hard, but that's how humility really grows.
One of the things that you mention as well is the idea of sort of doing a lot of reading, a lot of spiritual reading and non-spiritual reading, just great literature that you had done through college and as a young person, and trying to translate sort of the lessons from literature, from philosophy into action, into real life. How do you make that jump?
Yeah, that's one of the things I struggle with. I think I expected through college and through my 20s to read the book that would explain what I needed to do. It took me a long time to understand that wasn't going to happen. It took me many years.
Well, until your book has
been
written.
Of course, now that's out there, all those problems are solved for everybody else. You're very lucky. But I think everybody's circumstance is unique, so nobody is like anybody else. And there is a tremendous amount of wisdom out there to be gained through reading and prayer and many other things that we can do. And I strongly encourage everybody to do that, and I certainly devote a lot of my time to that personally. But I think, too, there's being in the world and doing whatever it is that you're doing, whether you're raising kids or you're working or you're doing both. And trying to take what you saw or what you learned from the literature and or from whatever art form you like, and then seeing how to apply that in day-to-day life. Again, like humility, it's the kind of thing that takes time. But I've found, I'm 39 now, and I work as a public relations professional. And just in the course of doing that work in my day job, a lot of circumstances will come up where something I read will, I'll see an opportunity to apply it or maybe to understand it better. So again, it's just a matter of playing with it and taking some time and allowing it to kind of come together for you.
Now, you mentioned earlier the idea of having multiple vocations. I mean, it sounds like it's hard enough to have just one vocation or to find one vocation. Can you explain to me a little bit the process of trying to discern, you know, how many vocations you might even have, never mind what they are?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would actually say, though I wouldn't have believed this maybe 10 years ago, I think it's actually better to have more vocations for yourself, and I think it's easier on you to have more vocations. And the reason I say that is I think we have a tendency sometimes to zero in on one thing too much, and you can burn yourself out on that. There's lots of examples of people wanting to be, you know, a writer or an athlete or whatever role we're talking about, and they pursue that to the exclusion of everything else, and I think in the end it's not healthy. So one thing I've realized in kind of stepping back to write this book is I would say I have a handful of vocations. I'm a father and a husband, so that's one right there, big vocation. I'm a writer. I'm a PR professional. I'm a Catholic. I think in being Catholic is a vocation in itself. And I like having all of those because I think they work together really well. So things that I might learn at work might actually inform my faith. Something I learned from spending time with my kids can inform my writing. When you get kind of a virtuous cycle like that going, it's really exciting, and I think it keeps you fresh and certainly never bored. It also helps you avoid the frustration of thinking that there's just one thing out there for me, and I've got to find it, and if I don't find it, I'm not going to be fulfilled. I think there's many things, and they're going to change as you get older.
A lot of times in the Catholic world, I think the word vocation implies a vocation to a religious life. Have you found that sort of perception in your discussions about vocation, that when you start talking to somebody about vocation, they think maybe you're recruiting them for a religious order? Or do you think that people have a better sense of what the word means in the sort of a secular way?
Yeah, that's another good question. I actually have only had a problem with that when I'm talking to Catholics. I live in North Carolina, and Catholic population there is very small. When I use the word vocation or calling, most people actually think of it as applying to them directly and is about finding your place in the world. So it's been very helpful to have it received that way. I tend to use the word calling probably a little more than vocation, but I think they both mean the same thing, and people seem to receive it that way.
And how do you react when you're talking to Catholics and they may misinterpret what you're meaning?
I mean, I do think, first of all, I mean, clearly there is a calling to be a religious, but I'm talking using the term just more broadly. I think that for a long time in the Catholic Church there was a problem with just lay members of the church not really seeing themselves as having their own callings necessarily, or callings that weren't as special as those of the religious. So it's good to be able to explain, hey, you know, this is for everybody. This is for Catholics, every Catholic. This is actually for every person, regardless of what your background is.
Now, what drew you to the vocation stories of some of the individuals that you feature in the book?
First of all, there's a lot of people that I just wanted to learn more about, and these are some of the stories that just stuck out in all the reading I had done. So one of the advantages of all the reading I did when I was trying to find a calling and thinking I could find it strictly through a book was that I read a lot of great stories. I think they showed that regardless of the background that people come from, there's a lot of different ways to find the calling. I was struck, for example, by Parker Palmer, who's a Quaker, a well-known writer and educator, and his story was amazing about his efforts to find a calling, to figure out what he really wanted to do. He didn't discover this until his 50s, and he had been a high-achieving person the whole time, and yet very unfulfilled, battling mental illness, and not only until he got to his 50s did he realize, hey, I think I finally zeroed in on what I want to do, and which a big part of which in his case was being a writer. And I thought that really struck me, because I think a lot of people start to get very worried as they get to my age or older, like, hey, shouldn't I have figured out yet what I'm here for? And that's frustrating, but I think the answer is no. It could take a long time. I don't think anybody at any point is really going to be able to say definitively, hey, I know my calling, and this is it, and this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, because your circumstances are going to change. You're going to evolve.
Right. It strikes me as a kind of process that's sort of continual.
It's very much a process. You know, I talk about the five practices, which are, you know, naming your desires, what you are drawn towards. And the second one is focus. So this is where you need to have the focus to really channel those desires. And the third of these practices is humility, which helps you step out. You can know your desires, and you can have focus and still be a really self-absorbed person. Even if you're great at those two areas, you still could be on the wrong track. So humility is really important. It gives you the perspective to channel that energy in the right direction. And then community is what even takes it out more broadly. That's where you're really learning from a broader group of people, immersing yourself in a community of people. And then finally, what I call margins, which is where you put yourself in a space that stretches you, it makes you uncomfortable. And then it actually, I think, creates a loop. You could write these down, it looks kind of linear, but actually, if you do the margins correctly, it'll probably prompt new desires, and then that'll kind of start the whole thing all over again.
Where have you seen yourself sort of on the margins in a way that has sort of pushed you to explore new desires?
For me, certainly having a family, and I think anybody who has a family is going to find this to be the case. You know, raising kids is a tremendous experience. It's also exhausting, really pushes you past the limits of what you thought you could do. And that's assuming that your kids don't have special challenges that have to be dealt with. This is just in ideal circumstances. I think for me, my writing career really actually got started in terms of writing for Catholic publications, really exploring book writing and essay writing once I had kids. I wasted a lot of time in my 20s thinking about the writing I was going to do. I didn't actually get started till I had kids and realized if I don't do this now, I'm never going to have the time to do it. It's hard to find any time. For me, that was a margins experience of realizing it's now or never. And then just realizing I got to be disciplined about, focused, you know, about getting it done. So that's certainly, having a family has had that effect on me. And then, you know, writing this book is a margins experience too. I'd always been very private about the anxiety disorder experience. Before the book came out, there might have been 10 people that knew that. That's why I gave my parents a copy in advance. they wouldn't be surprised. That putting that experience out there too, I was wondering how that would be received, and it's been received well. It turns out a lot of people struggle with the same challenges, and as I'd hoped, the book seems to be helping them a little bit with that.
You talk about raising your children. Do you hope that they may be able to pick up your book at some point and learn a little bit about the process for the, themselves?
Yes, I do. My kids are funny. My son's been reading a series of kid books that have 48 titles in the series, and he keeps saying to me, "When are you going to have Messy Quest 2 and Messy Quest 3?" I said, "It's gonna be a while, buddy." But no, I do hope that they can benefit. I've really tried to write it in a way that it's just steps that you can take, and there's no rush. You don't have to do the steps in order. You don't have to do them in a certain amount of time. I'm hoping when they're old enough to hopefully appreciate this kind of thing, that they'll pick it up and learn something about me and then something that can help them as well.
Right. And how old are they now?
They're 8 and 5.
8 and 5. Okay. Do you think there's a time when it's sort of too early to be looking at vocations? And not in the sense of a career path, but, how do you sort of instill some of the values that you're talking about and these ideas and desires in your kids so that when they are adults, maybe they do have an easier time sort of going through this process?
Right. My wife and I have really been trying to pay attention to what our kids are interested in. And I have an 8-year-old boy and a 5-year-old girl. They really have different personalities and different interests. And what we're trying to do now is just pay attention to what it is. My son, for example, seems to be really interested in history, music, reading, a number of things like that. So we're just trying to just give him some additional exposure to what he seems interested in. And the same with our daughter, who's interested in some things too, but some different athletic pursuits and reading and other things as well. So we're just really trying to see. I think one of the biggest things you can do for your kids is just help them see what they're drawn to and then help remind them of that later and then help them develop in those areas.
What do you think is the most commonly asked question about vocations that you receive?
One of the questions I get a lot is, which of these 5 practices is the hardest? It's a good question, and the answer I've been giving is that it just depends on who you are. For me, I'm a pretty introverted guy, and community has always been something I've been challenged by. I have a tendency, I'm more independent, kind of like to go off and do my own thing, and it's taken me a long time to realize the benefits of interacting really closely with other people and really taking their feedback seriously, both positive and negative, and learning from that. I tend to be very focused, but a lot of introverted people are focused. A lot of extroverted people struggle with focus, and that's something that I've been hearing in talking with people about the book, is many of them find margins and focus to be the toughest, but again, it just depends on who you are.
As you were writing your book, did you look back and say, I wish I could have changed this aspect of my life and then this would have been different? Or did you look back and say, now I see how it all kind of fits together? Because I imagine writing about this whole process was definitely a time for reflection on all of it.
Yeah, it was a great time for reflection. And my editor, Patrick McGowan at Ave Maria, really pushed me on this and actually helped me understand that some of the narratives I had in my head about my life needed to be reexamined. For example, who was responsible for the anxiety disorder? It turned out I wasn't really taking as much personal responsibility for that as I should have. I think I was blaming other people or other situations. And that was something that was very interesting that came out in writing the book. I think one of the biggest things I've learned from the whole thing is there were parts of my life that I regretted, not only the times that I was going through them, but later on. But I think writing the book has helped me understand that you shouldn't regret anything really in your life that's happened. Because, there's nothing you can do about it now. And the question now is, what are you going to try to learn from it? Reading a great book right now, actually, Richard Rohr, he's talking about the two halves of life. One of the things he really stresses is that in order to get to the second half of life, which is an area of greater spiritual awareness, you need to have gone through the first half of your life, gone through struggles and really reflected on them, and everything that happens works to your benefit if you let it. And I do believe that. I think that writing that book really showed that to me. I would have opted out of some of these things if I could have, but I think that would have been unfortunate in the long run.
Well, that makes sense. Well, thank you so much for sharing those events of your life, both in your book and with us here today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Carrie. It's a pleasure.